I'm Jennifer Ludden, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away this week. Coming up, two medical panels last week recommended less cancer screening for American women. That sparked confusion and a political uproar. We'll speak with a woman's advocate about the implications. But first, the Senate voted this weekend to open official debate of the health care overhaul plan. In a rare Saturday session, the Senate voted 60 to 39, right along party lines. The plan now faces weeks of debate and dozens of amendments that could change it substantially. NPR's congressional correspondent David Wellna covered the Saturday vote, and he joins us now. Hi, David.
Hi, Jennifer.
So the Senate needed 60 votes to start this debate, and apparently getting them was a real nail-biting experience for Senate leader Harry Reid. Can you recap for us what happened to persuade the late deciders?
Well, there were really three members of the Senate Democratic Caucus who held out until the very final hours before the vote. Senator Ben Nelson of Nebraska announced his intention to support this procedural motion to bring the bill to the floor on Friday, and that increased pressure on the other two holdouts, Louisiana's Mary Landrieu and Arkansas's Blanche Lincoln. Both of them announced hours before the vote on Saturday that they too would be voting with the Democrats, and that got them exactly to 60 votes, the absolute minimum number to head off a Republican filibuster of this bill, which would have basically bottled up the bill and kept it from being considered on the floor.
And was there some trade-off there? What'd they get?
Well, of course there were some trade-offs. Senator Reid, in fact, spoke with virtually every member of his caucus to find out what their concerns and what their needs were. We know that Mary Landrieu of Louisiana was given assurances in the legislation itself that there would be a special fund for states hit by big disasters for helping pay their Medicaid bills. And that, of course, seemed to single out one state, Louisiana, because of Katrina. And that there was at least $100 million to help defray additional Medicaid costs in the future from this legislation. And that's being called the Louisiana Purchase, because, in fact, she swung over and joined the Democrats after that happened.
Now, it was a party-line vote, but there is lots of dissension, clearly, among Democrats themselves. One of the most contentious issues, the so-called public option, under which the federal government would offer a public health insurance plan. What is the likelihood that of this being approved as it is now in the final version of a Senate bill?
Well, it's not clear. This is an opt-out plan. That is, states that don't want to participate are able to opt out of it. But it is a national plan. And some senators, such as Nebraska's Ben Nelson, are saying that if that plan stays as it is in the bill, they will join a Republican filibuster to keep the bill from coming to a final vote. That would really derail it. So there's an expectation that there will be attempts to modify the bill. Nelson says that he'd be happy to have an opt-in plan where states could choose to be in a public option, but it wouldn't be assumed that all of them would. Others, such as independent Connecticut Joe Lieberman, are saying simply that if there's any public option in the plan, they too will filibuster this. So there will be a lot of horse trading going on the floor. There's the idea that there might be a trigger that would enact a public option only if private insurance companies were not offering affordable rates. This is something that Maine Republican Senator Olympia Snowe, the only Republican in the Senate to have voted for any of the committee healthcare plans, backs. And it's something that is seeming to pick up a certain amount of speed. At the same time, you have liberal Democrats saying, if you change this public option and water it down any further, we're not going to back the bill. So there's quite a quandary for Majority Leader Reid.
So, David, what happens next?
Well, the bill is now officially going to be taken up and amended on the floor. Both sides are going to be able to offer amendments. The thing is that because Democrats have 60 members in their caucus, they are going to probably be able to stop most of the Republican-offered amendments. Republicans feel that they don't have the votes really to alter this bill. One issue that they feel they can pick up Democrats on is abortion. The language in The Senate bill is somewhat less restrictive than the House bill on the rules governing which companies could offer coverage that includes abortion and which couldn't. And there are going to be efforts to make that language much more restrictive. But even the proponents of that fear that they don't have the 60 votes to change that. So I think we're going to hear a lot of rhetoric from Republicans on the floor, but probably not a lot of Republican amendments going through.
David Wellna is NPR's congressional correspondent. Thank you so much, David.
You're welcome, Jennifer.
A new flashpoint in the healthcare debate is over controversial recommendations for cancer screening for women. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, a government-appointed panel of independent experts, last week came out against annual mammograms for women under 50, and it said those above 50 should get the test only every other year. The American Cancer Society, among other groups, flatly rejected that advice. A few days later, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists recommended reduced screening of young women for cervical cancer. Both efforts have left many women confused about when and how often they should be screened. Joining me now to talk about the new guidelines is Cindy Pearson. She's executive director of the National Women's Health Network, and she's here in our Washington studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
Cindy, your organization welcomed these new guidelines for mammograms. Tell me why.
We actually think that women's health will be improved in the United States if we seek a better balance of bringing in the relatively few women who still aren't screened at all, so that's where the health reform bills are important to us, and taking a step back and screening a little bit less the women who are already in the system. There's ways in which women's health gets hurt by too much screening.
And now, go ahead.
It's counterintuitive. It's hard to understand, and it really contradicts the very simple messages that we've been getting all along, but it is important.
Well, you said on your website that in 1993 already, it was shown that, quote, mammography screening doesn't work well for women before menopause and not at all for women under 40. Now, as someone who goes in very religiously every year and, you know, feels panicky if I get behind, that was news to me.
That's right. And that's why we didn't jump for joy when the news came out on Monday, but we did have an element of pleasure and happiness because we wanted women to finally get a more full understanding of what mammography screening can and can't do. And we don't want any woman ever to have the feelings that you've had of, oh my gosh, I'm behind. I'm letting myself down. I'm letting my loved ones down. Mammography screening is not like buckling your seatbelt. It's not an absolute no-brainer that if you do it, it'll save your life, and if you don't, you're careless and thoughtless. It's just not that easy.
Now, your organization has actually been calling for quite a few years for some better technology that might be more accurate. You say something like more like a pap smear. What do you envision, and why don't we have that?
I think we don't have that because what worked initially in the first test in the 1960s, this approach of X-ray, using X-rays to look inside the breast tissue and try to determine whether there's a lesion, a small tumor, or precancerous changes, it worked in the first study, so all the efforts since then were to make it better. But it comes up against an impossible barrier that it's just never going to leap over, which is that at early ages, women's breast tissue is sensitive to radiation and can actually cause cancer. We know that now clearly. It's not a controversy anymore.
So too many mammograms can actually cause cancer later in life.
Probably not, because as we age, our breasts become less sensitive and the level of radiation that's used is very, very small now. But it would never be able to be used as a screening technique for women in their teens, 20s, or 30s. Cancer isn't very common there, but boy, is it real. It happens. And those women deserve a screening technique, just like women who've been looking at cervical cancer screening have had access to a screening technique that works equally well when they're a teenager or a grandmother.
The pap smear. Now, the calls for reduced screening have prompted cries of rationing. This is what Republican Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn from Tennessee had to say.
This is how rationing begins. This is the little toe in the edge of the water. And this is where you start getting a bureaucrat between you and your physician.
Cindy Pearson, how do you respond to that?
rationing exists in this country right now. It exists in the experience of women who get free screening and then can't get treated because they don't have insurance. I've talked to women who needed to come up with a high amount of money just to finish the diagnostic process. We've all seen stories of women who have their treatment interrupted because they've lost their insurance or their insurance has met its limit. That's rationing. That's right now. This attempt to balance how much screening is the right amount is an attempt to move forward in a scientific and medically sound way to finding what's best overall.
Now, when we talk about African American women, though, there is a bit of a different story there. They are more likely to get breast cancer earlier.
Yes.
So what do these guidelines mean for them?
Young African American women have in many ways been out in the cold the last 16 years because they are more likely to get cancer diagnosed before age 40 than any other group of women in the United States. And there is no good screening technique for women under age 40. We've tried to use clinical breast exams and teaching breast self-exam. Those work somewhat, but they're not great. And so all these years, we should have been really taking it as a top priority to look for something that works in a completely different way so that these women, as well as the rest of young women, would have some sort of reliable screening technique to turn to.
We have just a few seconds left, but as you watch the healthcare bills work their way through Congress, what do we know so far about what they would say about these kinds of preventive screenings?
They would take away any copays, which is a great step forward so that there's not a barrier of having to pay part of the cost. And they would give women access to screening on a schedule that's been decided by a group of physicians, educated consumers, and researchers. So we would have a public discussion going forward about what is the screening schedule for this and any other kind of
screening. And do you see these new recommendations really influencing that debate? I guess we're off on that one already.
Yeah, they would. They absolutely would, as they should.
Cindy Pearson is the Executive Director of the National Women's Health Network. Thanks so much for coming in.
You're welcome.
I'm Jennifer Ludden, in for Michelle Martin. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we'll hear from a psychologist about how our brains react to hot-button political topics. But first, all this week, NPR is taking a look at the safety of our highways and roads in a series we're calling On the Road to Safety. Here at Tell Me More, we're going to explore the risks to road safety posed by unlicensed and uninsured drivers. In a moment, the debate over the potential benefits and drawbacks of driver's licenses for undocumented immigrants. Right now, just three American states, Illinois, New Mexico, and Washington State, allow the undocumented to have a license. First, we'll get a broader snapshot of the safety issues with Loretta Werders. She's vice president of the Insurance Information Institute. Welcome.
Thank you.
So let's start with a basic question. How many uninsured drivers are there in the U.S.?
Well, you know, it's kind of hard to document that when, you know, you don't have the actual numbers. You don't have those people coming up to you and saying, I'm not licensed. So, but we do feel that there is a substantial number of people who are uninsured in this country. In fact, one in 16 drivers nationwide we feel will be uninsured by next year.
And I know you're. It's hard to get numbers at all, but any idea of that, how many would be undocumented immigrants?
Really hard to tell. Again, the same problem, of course, because they are undocumented, that it's difficult until an accident happens and you know that that person has no insurance.
How much variation is there state to state?
Quite a bit. Actually, interesting, New Mexico has about 29%, the highest uninsured drivers in the country compared to Massachusetts, which is about 1% and is, in fact, the lowest.
That's interesting because New Mexico is one of now only a handful of states left who does still issue licenses to the undocumented.
Correct.
And you said Massachusetts has the lowest rate.
Massachusetts has the lowest rate with 1%.
Any idea why?
It's hard to determine. It could be there is more education in the part of that state, but there's clearly a correlation with New Mexico and the fact that people who are undocumented can get licenses.
Now, to flip the question around a little bit, we don't really know how many of the uninsured are undocumented. Do you have any idea how many undocumented workers might carry auto insurance, regardless of whether or not they have a driver's license?
I think the percentage would be relatively low. For the same reasons, I think a lot of undocumented workers who are illegal aliens may have some concerns about perhaps being deported back to their native country. So there's a big fear on their part to have any kind of dealings with government officials or with any kind of state officials.
But technically speaking, do you need a license to get insurance?
Yes, you do. Most states require drivers to have auto liability insurance before they can legally drive a car.
Now, from an insurance industry perspective, what are some of the concerns of having, presumably, this growing number of undocumented workers without licenses?
Well, the big concern for the industry as a whole is certainly the undocumented workers, but the issue in general of being uninsured in this country. You know, when you have that many people that are uninsured, there's a concern about safety issues. There's a concern about, you know, the liability aspects, which could be quite chilling.
You mentioned safety and liability issues. Can you tell me more?
Certainly, liability insurance is compulsory in 49 states and the District of Columbia. It is an important type of coverage to have because those people who don't have liability insurance and are involved in an accident could be liable for hundreds of thousands of dollars in medical bills and any kind of injuries that are done to that person. So it's really important to have that kind of coverage.
And if they can't pay that, if there's no insurance, then does the victim of that accident bear that responsibility?
Well, actually, what could happen, the courts could award the home and sell the home off on the person and any assets.
This is the victim
have.
Or the person who
this
perpetrated?
This is the person who, the perpetrator who hit them, would be liable, and any kind of salary that they do have would be garnished. Any future earnings would be garnished. Their home could be sold and taken away from them. It's really a devastating situation if anybody is involved and does not have insurance.
Loretta Werters is vice president of the Insurance Information Institute, and she joined us from our New York bureau. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now let's look a little more at the policy concerns over undocumented immigrants and driver's licenses. Joining me is Kevin Johnson, dean of the University of California Davis School of Law. Also, Ira Melman, he's media director for the Federation of American Immigration Reform. Welcome to you both.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Kevin Johnson, let me start with you. Where do we stand now with state laws that allow undocumented immigrants to have a driver's license?
Well, there are relatively, as you mentioned before, there's relatively few states that currently allow undocumented immigrants to secure a driver's license. California, until 1994, did permit undocumented immigrants, if they satisfy the safety testing, to secure a driver's license. But over the years, a number of states, including California, have eliminated that possibility for undocumented immigrants. And New Mexico and a handful of other states now are the only ones left that do permit undocumented immigrants to secure a driver's license.
And this is a process that has really accelerated since 9/11, is that correct?
I think that it began before September 11th. It began really in the 1990s. In California, it began with the passage of the measure known as Proposition 187, which was designed for the states to reduce public benefits to undocumented immigrants. And that was followed up by increased border enforcement later in the 90s and in 1996 immigration reform. And it did get some renewed attention after September 11th. But I think it's been a process that's been going on for well over a decade.
Ira Melman, your group encourages states to deny licenses for the undocumented. Tell me the rationale.
Well, if people are in the country illegally, we should not be facilitating their presence here and making it easier for them to live, work, and do whatever it is that they want to do in this country. A driver's license is an important document, not just for the purpose of operating a motor vehicle, but it is used as a piece of identification for just about all sorts of things that people need to identify themselves for. And there is no reason why state governments ought to be handing this valuable piece of documentation to people who have no right to be in the country to begin with.
But what about safety concerns? If you don't have a license and then you can't get insurance, what about the risk to road safety in that sense?
Well, the alternative to giving everybody who's here illegally licenses is to start enforcing motor vehicle codes and enforcing the law against people who drive without licenses. If people understood that if we catch you driving without a license, we're going to impound your vehicle, we're going to call ICE and say, come take a look at this guy because he might be in the country illegally, that would be a deterrent to people who are in the country illegally driving without licenses.
Kevin Johnson, are there lax enforcement of motor vehicle laws?
No, I don't think so at all. And actually, I take a slightly different position on this issue. I'm very interested in public safety, and I think that all drivers on the road, hopefully, are licensed. Because if you have a license, then you have been subjected to some kind of safety testing. And I'd prefer that all drivers on the road, documented or not, have that safety testing. And that's why we have licensing laws. At the same time, as we've heard, if you don't have a driver's license, you can't obtain liability insurance. And so the current situation is very anti-safety in terms of most Americans. So this current system in many states where undocumented immigrants can obtain a driver's license is unsafe for U.S. citizens and lawful immigrants. And in my mind, doesn't make a lot of sense.
What do we know about, you know, if states are denying licenses to the undocumented, does that mean that they're actually not driving or that they're driving anyway, or do they stay home?
I don't think there's any evidence, really, that people without licenses who need to get to work, who do work here, and we're talking about 12 million undocumented immigrants who our best estimates show live in the United States, there's no evidence that they're not driving. It's unfortunate that they can't secure licenses in many states, but that increases the safety risks. I mean, there are some issues about how we treat the undocumented immigrants and whether we're treating them fairly or not in the current situation. But this current system tends to drive them more underground and creates the possibility that they're more likely to flee when stopped, more likely to create unsafe situations for officers and themselves upon a stop. And in many ways, is just not safe.
Ira Melman, what about that argument?
Well, there are other ways of convincing people who don't have driver's licenses not to drive. You know, just because somebody is here doesn't mean that we have to permit them to drive. And as Ms. Werders a little while ago pointed out, giving somebody a driver's license if they're in the country illegally is no guarantee that they're going to get the liability insurance that we all think people on the road ought to have. As she pointed out, New Mexico, which is the one state that actually affirmatively says you can get a driver's license if you're an illegal alien. And they have the highest rate of uninsured drivers. And it's because you have a large group of people who have shown disregard for the law. They were encountered an immigration law that was inconvenient. They disobeyed it. The law says they're not allowed to work in this country. They tell us they're driving the car to get to work. But what makes us think that people who have shown a disregard for the law are going to go out and spend a couple thousand dollars a year to buy insurance to protect assets they don't have in the first place?
Kevin Johnson, I understand that some states are kind of cutting it in the middle here, and they're coming up with what's called a two-tier license. Can you explain that?
Well, that's where there'd be some identification on the license that the person isn't a U.S. citizen.
So that would mean they could drive, but, for example, maybe not board a plane with the license.
Correct. And that's been challenged by some state legislatures, is opening the door to racial profiling. As signaling to police, this person may well be undocumented, look more carefully. So that's been the concern with that kind of a licensing scheme. I mean, but I do think it's important to remember that we were fine before 1994. And in many ways, I think the specter of disaster that would come with allowing undocumented immigrants to obtain licenses is overstated.
Ira Melman, what about this notion of a two-tier license where you signal that someone's not a citizen and the license is very restricted in its use? Would you support that?
No, there is no reason to make it easy for people to live in the United States illegally. If you want to control illegal immigration, you have to make it as difficult as possible for people to live here in the United States in violation of the law. Each time you make it easier, you encourage more people to break the law.
But if the issue is road safety...
There are other ways of ensuring road safety, and as Ms. Werders pointed out, giving people driver's licenses who are in the country illegally is no guarantee that they're going to get insurance, and New Mexico is a perfect example. The easiest state to get a driver's license in if you're an illegal alien, and the highest rate of uninsured drivers.
Ira Melman is media director for the Federation of American Immigration Reform and joined us from his office in Seattle. Kevin Johnson is dean of the University of California Davis School of Law, and he joined us from their studios. Thank you, both of you.
Thanks very much.
Two topics we've just heard about today, illegal immigration and health care, are among the hottest of hot-button political issues. Attempts at a level-headed, fact-based discussion can easily be taken over by passionate emotions on either side. So why is that? Drew Weston is an Emory University professor of psychology and author of The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. He joins us from Atlanta, Georgia. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on, Jennifer.
So, Professor Weston, how does our brain process political messages?
Well, you know, it's interesting to listen to the discussion we've just heard, because what you tend to hear from the right are powerful emotional phrases, and what you tend to hear from the left are rational discussions. And our brains really evolved to first hear the emotional side and second to think about it. And really, in many ways, for good reasons, because, you know, when humans were evolving, if you see a snake, if you stop and say, well, let me see, what genus and species is that? You're probably dead. And if you respond first to the emotion, oh, as a snake, you jump away from it.
So does that mean the right always has an advantage, or whoever is using the most emotion in its debate? I mean, on illegal immigration, for example.
Well, you know, our brains evolved to integrate reason and emotion, but the right does have an advantage because they understand that these issues are emotional issues, and Democrats and the left keep returning to them as rational issues. I mean, a great example being the safety issue with immigration. You can't get to that. You don't want to even talk about that safety issue if you're a proponent of rights for illegal immigrants. If you start from the point of view of let's talk about this as a safety issue, you first have to allay people's concerns about the illegal immigrants we have in this country first. And you'll notice it was not an accident that your guests who were coming from the right. Ira Melman was a great example of this. He never failed to use terms like illegal aliens, which turns people into, you know, some mutant variant of ET.
The undocumented immigrant worker that the left would favor.
Absolutely. And in fact, actually, that's a great one. Here's one where you can probably get away with undocumented workers on NPR. But in general, I've actually pulled this, is that it turns out that undocumented workers is actually a worse phrase to use if you want to advance the cause of doing something progressive or reasonable for the 12 million illegal immigrants we have in this country now, because people hear that as a euphemism, or when they hear undocumented, where their mind goes to is, well, a bunch of them do have documents. What kind of documents are they? They're forged documents.
Uh-huh.
And people are a lot more bothered by the idea of forgery than they are about people coming over the border to try to feed their kids.
Isn't that interesting? Let's move to health care now. We should note you have consulted with Georgia's State Democratic Party, but a lot of the opposition to health care overall has been from Republicans. We've had raucous town hall meetings and Tea Party demonstrations. How do you analyze the Republican strategy on health care?
Well, the Republican strategy was clear. I actually led up the messaging efforts for some nonpartisan groups back during and immediately before the presidential election. And the messaging strategy for the Republicans was clear back then what it was going to be, which is, and you heard it actually from the Republican congresswoman who I think we heard on before, who talked about rationing and a bureaucrat becoming between you and your physician. It's basically to tell a very, very simple story, which is that what Democrats really want is to step in between you and your doctor, because they fundamentally don't believe in the free market, and they fundamentally believe that some bureaucrat in Washington knows better than you do how to spend your health care dollars and what kind of decisions you should make. It's a really, really simple but frankly emotionally very compelling argument.
Now, what about just briefly the argument that President Obama over on the Democratic side somehow just can't get emotional enough about selling health care?
It's absolutely right. I mean, the only way that you can get people, I mean, this is inherently an emotional issue, because it touches all of us. But part of the problem is that when you're trying to talk about an issue like this, you really have to tell a story the way the Republicans do, which is a story that has antagonists, that has protagonists. It's the kind of story that our brains really evolved to hear.
And okay.
the president does not like to have antagonists in his stories.
Professor Drew Weston, you're going to stick with us a few minutes more, but we're going to take a short break right now. Professor Weston is author of The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Jennifer Ludden. I'm Jennifer Ludden, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. Coming up, the latest wave of immigration, not from Latin America, but to it. That story in a few moments. First, though, we continue our discussion of emotion as a political force. Our guest is Emory University psychology professor Drew Weston. He's the author of The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. And, Professor, thanks for staying with us.
Happy to be here.
Now, on Friday, President Obama's approval rating for the first time dropped below 50% as measured by Gallup. In her Sunday New York Times column, Maureen Dowd suggested that President Obama could learn a thing or two from Sarah Palin on how to be more visceral and connect with voters on a gut level. It sounds like you might agree.
Well, actually, I'd go back a little further than Sarah Palin, probably back to FDR, who had the most similar circumstances to President Obama. I mean, what FDR did in a case like this when he was facing one industry after another that was really fleecing the American public, he said to them, and he said quite famously, you know, at no time in our history, in the history of this country, have so many powerful special interests focused their hatred on one man. And I welcome their hatred. And what he did then was to go on and to say, systematically, he went through and he went after every one of those industries that were endangering the financial security of Americans. He built a WPA, a work program, so that people could go back to work or out of work. And he minced no words about this being Hoover's depression. It was the Republicans' depression. It was the depression that came from unregulated greed. And President Obama just will not do that. He will not blame the recession or this great recession on anyone.
Though his critics claim that he keeps doing that and is doing it for too long, and people are starting to now associate the recession with him.
Well, they're associating the recession with him because he never mentioned from the start that this was a recession that he inherited. You know, he has actually never once uttered the name George Bush since he's been president. And only on three or four occasions has he said, I inherited this, guys. And this was something that I actually wrote about in the first week of his presidency, arguing that he was going to have a failed presidency if he didn't start branding this recession as the recession caused by Bush and the Republicans, as caused by a philosophy of unregulated greed. And that if he didn't start talking about why we needed deficit spending right now, because otherwise he was going to get stuck with a $1.2 trillion deficit that he was left with, it was going to get blamed on him. And just in terms of strategies for that, FDR played offense on that. So he went right after the bankers. He ran four times in a row against Hoover.
And yet we have President Obama, who really ran on the fact that he could rise above this conflict. So you're saying instead of rising above, he needs to kind of wallow in it and play it up?
I think what he'd like to do is to not have the conflict at all and to stay out of it. And the problem is that if you're going to run on reform, if you're going to say we need big changes, you have to do two things from an emotional standpoint. The first is you have to make people concerned about what the current situation is, which they sure were back in January, and you have to make them angry towards the people who caused it. If you don't do those two things and then follow it with your message of hope, What's going to happen to you is what has happened to President Obama, which is people are now, you know, are now blaming the recession on him. They're basically saying, hey, you broke this. You broke this. You own it.
All right. Drew Weston is Emory University professor of psychology. He's also the author of The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation, and joined us from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
As Europe cracks down on illegal migration, more and more Africans are heading to Latin America. Brazil and Argentina are the most popular destinations. Both have seen a spike in asylum seekers from Africa. And while these governments may be more open to immigration, the process of integrating these newcomers is not always smooth. We're joined now by Anil Mundra. Until recently, he was based in Argentina for Global Post. Also with us is Professor Clarence Lussain of American University's School of International Service. He works with African rights groups in Brazil. And welcome to both of you.
Thanks.
It's great to be here.
Professor Lussain, let me start with you. Why are Africans winding up in Brazil?
Well, Brazil is attractive for a number of reasons. One is that it has a large black population. But it's also attractive because it actually has extremely progressive refugee policies. And those are known increasingly around the world among refugees. And that attraction and the word of mouth that is spread around the receptivity of people coming to Brazil has meant that there's been a large increase of people of African descent, both from the continent of Africa, but also from the Caribbean, for example.
Anil Mundra, you've done stories on African newcomers to Argentina. Why did they tell you they went there?
You know, everyone said that they came because the economy was good. Now, that's kind of ironic because the Argentine economy is not very good. It had a terrible, it has a crisis every decade, basically. The last one was in 2001. And still, you know, some questionable policies and generally not in great shape lately. But there seems to be maybe a misconception. Most of them didn't have any idea what they were getting into. Most of the people coming to Argentina these days are Senegalese, and they would be what the UN would call economic migrants. They wouldn't be considered refugees. And they're coming to make money, but it seems like it was a word-of-mouth phenomenon again. And someone said, you know, Argentina is a good place to go, and then it just kind of ballooned from there.
Anil, you actually spoke with a Senegalese man who felt discriminated against. He had a finance degree, he spoke four languages, actually became a citizen in Argentina, but he wasn't really kind of living the Argentinian dream, as it might be.
Yeah, he was actually Congolese. There's very few Congolese there now, and that's partly, I think, he tells me that's partly because he's told everybody not to come because it's not a good place for people like him. He is very outspoken about the discrimination in Argentine society and in the government. Now, it's a mixed thing. Everyone, particularly, you know, people that are street vendors, and so they're interacting with citizens and police on the street every day, everyone has their stories of being called racial slurs, some of them being physically assaulted, especially by police. But they usually go on to qualify that and say, well, that's the exception. And basically, we're earning more money here than we could back at home. And we're basically happy.
So, Professor Clarence Lussain, what about those Africans who land in Brazil? What are the policies there and what happens to them if they're arriving without documentation?
Well, this goes back to 2004. There was an agreement signed called the Mexico Plan of Action to Strengthen International Protection of Refugees. And it was signed by 20 countries, including Brazil, Argentina, the U.S., Canada, 16 other countries. And what it did was to create a broad framework under which rights were designated that were to be available for people who were coming as refugees or people who were seeking asylum. And this was really important because it meant, unlike in Europe, for example, there were rights that refugees have. For example, the right to freedom of movement. In many European countries, you're very restricted to not only certain cities, but certain parts of certain cities, where in Brazil, once you're accepted as a refugee, you can pretty much go anywhere. You also have a right to work. You also have rights in terms of access to education, access to health care. Now, all of this is listed as rights, and all of this is in a broad context, a very progressive framework. The reality of how these things are actually carried out, though, can be very, very different.
Really? Because tell me, I mean, it does make, like you said, sense. There is a historically a big population in Brazil of African descendants, so it would seem to be a welcoming society. But how does that play out?
For the most part, they're being received well, particularly by the Afro-Brazilian community. In the north, for example, you see the African population mix very well with the Afro-Brazilian population. And part of this is that some of the immigrants, those who are there legally, are there as business people, and they've opened up shops, they've opened up clubs, they've opened up stores, and so their relationship with those communities are seen as very progressive and positive.
Now, I'm curious, a lot of the Africans who are going to Latin America are Muslim, and we're talking about two very Catholic countries, right, Brazil and Argentina. Clarence Lussain, has that been an issue?
It's emerging as an issue, in part because in Brazil there's been an upsetting of religious homogeneity, because Catholicism, of course, has dominated the country's history. But in recent years, evangelicalism has emerged, and the African religions, particularly Candomblé, has also emerged as strong alternatives to Catholicism. So within that mix, a number of the African immigrants and refugees who are Muslim have also begun to identify themselves along their religious lines. And you've also had, in a small way, a number of converts within Brazil society to Islam. So that's also, to some degree, a factor in that there's an openness for people who come who may not necessarily be Catholic.
Anil, did you see this religious tension in Argentina?
Yeah, I didn't see tension exactly. You know, again, from a historical perspective, there actually has been a lot of Muslim immigration to Argentina as well as to Brazil, largely in the 19th century. And those were mostly Arab immigrants. But Argentina is now, I mean, it's got the largest mosque in South America. It's got several mosques in Buenos Aires. The previous president, Carlos Menem, he actually was born into a Muslim family and was elected president, which is something we haven't seen here in the U.S. So arguably, Muslims are more easily received in Argentina than they are in the United States.
Anil Mundra is a former correspondent in Argentina for the Global Post. Professor Clarence Lussain is with American University School of International Service and co-chairs the U.S. Civil Society Committee. Thanks so much, for both of you, for speaking with us.
Thank you.
After 24 years on the air, Oprah Winfrey announced on Friday she would end her show, The Oprah Winfrey Show, in September of 2011.
After much prayer and months of careful thought, I've decided that next season, season 25, will be the last season of The Oprah Winfrey Show. These years with you, our viewers, have enriched my life beyond all measure.
There are few talk show hosts who've interviewed as many big-name actors, authors, and political dignitaries. Oprah's talked to them all. And this got us thinking about who might be chosen as the guest on Oprah's very last show. Never mind, it's almost 2 years away. For ideas, we've called Chicago Now blogger and WGN-TV reporter Marcus Lashak. On his blog, The Lashak Value, he lists some 20 or so contenders for this final guest chair. And he joins us now. Marcus, welcome.
Hello, Jennifer.
So in your blog, you take the attitude that it's never too early to speculate about something like this.
No, of course not, especially not on the internet. Yeah, I finally have stopped crying here in Chicago. So many people are so upset about this. We were just talking about this in our newsroom. Could any other person ever on television announce that they were going to retire in 2 years and it'd be like front page news? It's unbelievable.
So looking ahead then, give us some of your contenders. Who might be that big-time last guest on Oprah?
Well, you know, I started the list just looking at people who have been on Oprah frequently. Somebody like Chris Rock, I believe, is the in the lead with 11 times being on her show. Others like Jim Carrey, Julia Roberts, people who might have been more popular about 10 years ago. But from the people who have been on there very frequently, one of my favorite guests is Will Smith. Anytime he's on the Oprah show, something wild happens. Doesn't matter if whatever he's promoting is garbage or anything like that. But whenever Will's on, it seems to be a very exciting show. He could be a fun last guest.
Well, I think we have a clip of one of his appearances there. Will Smith was a guest on the show in November of last year. Here's just after the election of President Obama.
The Chicago Sun-Times that just had the picture of him, and it had, the only headline was Mr. President.
Wow.
I saw that. Just saying it now makes me a little...
Oprah, I'm not going to be, I'm an action hero. I can't be crying on your show.
I know. Did you cry?
I won't be crying at stuff, Oprah. Listen, I was crying.
I was.
Okay, so Will Smith can go on Oprah and cry there. Maybe he doesn't do that anywhere else. What's a number two pick?
A number two pick, of course, if we want to keep it on the celebrity front, Tom Cruise. How about ruining another couch on the Oprah Winfrey set?
She's probably got another one ready for him there.
I'm sure she like snaps her fingers and a couch just appears out of nowhere, Oprah Winfrey. But that appearance had to be one of the most bizarre and captivating appearances ever on television.
And this is, of course, when Tom Cruise declared his love for the lady who would become his wife, Katie Holmes. And let's relive a bit of the moment here.
We've never seen you behave this way before.
I know.
Have you ever felt this way before?
So maybe she'll get some more jumping around there. What about let's go for a third. What's pick number three?
One for me, I would be very interested to hear from Mr. Stedman Graham. Are you familiar with who Stedman is?
I'm not.
Well, Stedman is Oprah's longtime boyfriend.
Uh-huh.
Who has lurked behind the scenes of this whole mess over the last 25 years or so. I'd love to see him get up there on the stage and tell us some tales. I'm sure he has plenty of things to talk about what it's like to date Oprah.
And see if she can get him to get as personal as some of the other folks.
There you go. And another one that's a personal favorite of mine, I would love this to happen, being a longtime Chicagoan, Roger Ebert, the film critic, of course, of Siskel and Ebert back in the day. About 25 years ago, Roger Ebert went on a date with Oprah Winfrey, and he convinced her to go into syndication. It's a very interesting connection to Chicago luminaries. To see him up on that stage, especially with all of the problems he's going through now with the cancer that he's fighting, it'd be very fitting, especially from a Chicagoan's point of view, to see those two up there and just talk about their life together. So many people don't know about that.
Kind of bringing it full circle then, if he helped her launch.
Yeah.
This last show is, am I correct, it's supposed to be in September of...
2011. You don't have it circled on your calendar yet? I was joking earlier, the Mayans were only 1 year off. The world will end in 2011 now because Oprah won't be on TV. There'll be no reason to live anymore.
Okay, well, it will still be a year before the next presidential election, but am I crazy to think that Oprah, who kind of broke precedent here by coming out and stumping for president, now President Obama, you think she's going to go for that big of a get?
Oh, I think for sure. And I think Obama would be foolish to turn her down. She did so much for him, campaigning for him back in the election there, that was my pick for the obvious choice to have both Barack Obama and Michelle Obama come out on the show, and they can all raise their hands together and help him get to the White House again. Some other people were saying maybe Sarah Palin once again will make an appearance because she might be running for president then. I don't think Oprah will have her on in 2011 like she had the other day. So,
well, I guess we'll just have to wait and see. Marcus Leshock is a feature reporter at WGN-TV and a blogger at Chicago Now. His blog is called The Leshock Value, and he joined us from Chicago. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. I'm Jennifer Ludden, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow. Getting jiggy with it.